David's books, Sweet Poison, The Sweet Poison Quit Plan, Big Fat Lies, you know, these are making a huge difference to the way people are thinking about nutrition. And he is a lawyer who's really done the research to bring information that's easily understandable to all of us. So let's give a big warm welcome to David Gillespie.
Thanks very much for being here, and thanks for that lovely introduction. As Jamie said, I've written some books about some stuff here, but first of all, you might be wondering why you need to listen to a lawyer about nutrition or health or biochemistry, which is what we're going to be talking about today. And the answer is that I have almost no relevant qualifications. So take that on board before we start. The only relevant qualification I had when I set out on this journey, for want of a better word, it was an ability to collect and examine evidence. That is my day job, collecting evidence. And my day job involves understanding evidence that has nothing to do with lawyering. So if we're going to litigate about a bridge, then I have to understand all of the engineering associated with whether bridges stay up or fall down. And I applied that skill, which is assembling diverse evidence, to a problem that I had, which was that I was 40 kilos heavier than I am now, and we were about to turn our four kids under the age of 9 into six kids under the age of 10, when my wife very inconsiderately announced that we were about to have twins. I wasn't coping with the four we already had, and I certainly wasn't going to cope with adding twin babies to that mix. So I thought, you know what, it's time to start doing something serious about my weight. It's not like I'd woken up one morning 40 kilos heavier. It had happened very, very slowly over time, year after year after year. Oh, by the way, in case you're wondering what on earth this has to do with anything I'm saying, the answer is nothing, yet. I'm not much of a one for slides, but there are some really interesting graphs that I wanted to show you during the course of my presentation, and I will get to it. So, I woke up not 40 kilos heavier, just a kilo heavier every year or so. And every year or so, I tried to do something about it. You know, I'd see a diet on the television, low-carb diet, or an Atkins diet, or an eat cabbage soup for a month diet, or, you know, live on bananas diet, or detox your liver diet, and I'd try them all. And they'd all work. To one degree or another. You'd lose a kilo or two every week that you're prepared to stay on them. And for me, that was until my willpower gave out, which was usually around about the 2 week mark. And then the weight would come back, usually with interest. So I thought to myself, there's something that I'm missing about how our bodies work. And I'm a kind of a how does this work sort of a fellow. And I thought, there must be evidence out there, there must be information out there, I'm just not understanding it. Because when you look around at the planet, every other species on the planet appears to be able to control its weight in exactly the same way it controls its height, on autopilot. The only ones that don't are us and the animals we feed. And that's it. Everybody else does just fine. There are no orangutans signing up for Jenny Craig. There are no gymnasiums for elephants. It all just works on autopilot. And so I thought there must be evidence that we must, surely we figured this out by now. I'm just clearly misunderstanding it. And so I went looking for that evidence. And the place I started was, you know, the official places, the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare, where the people who tell us what we should eat. They tell us that if you eat fat, you'll be fat. If you don't exercise, you'll be fatter. So in other words, their explanation for what was going on was sloth and gluttony. It appears that they'd opened the Bible, turned up the seven deadly sins, and stopped at that as an explanation for everything. I didn't find that convincing. I found it even less convincing when I realised where those statements had come from. So the fat bit, fat makes you fat, had come from an observation made during the 1950s when the obesity epidemic was out of control. It'd be insignificant by today's standards, but they were really worried about it in the 1950s. And what they observed was that, you know what, if you burn things in a test tube, fat gives off 9 calories of energy And protein and carbohydrate, which is everything else, gives off 4 calories of energy per gram. Therefore, fat is twice as calorie dense as everything else, gram for gram. Therefore, if your food has fat in it, it will have more calories in it than anything else. Obviously, if you eat food with fat in it, you will get fat. It's that simple. Obvious. And it's the basis for most of the health messaging we get today. That's it. That was all the thinking that was done. There was no account taken of the fact that we are a complex metabolic system that is more than capable of determining the calorie intake of everything we eat and adjusting accordingly. None of that. Just this plain, flat-out guess. The one on exercise was even worse. There was a study done in the early 1950s that said, you know what? Fat people don't exercise as much as thin people. And it's true. They did a study, thousands of people, and when you look at the results, the people who were overweight didn't do as much exercise as the people who weren't. And they explained that with one of two possible explanations. The one they chose was the reason they're overweight is because they don't exercise. An alternate and equally viable explanation on the data was the reason they don't exercise is because they're overweight. And anyone who's ever lost a significant amount of weight would know that that's true. Because I didn't do any exercise before I lost 40 kilos, and I do a lot more now. Not because I am a crazed exercise fanatic, I'm the last person to be that, but because I feel like it more. I have more energy for it, which is one of the benefits of losing weight. So anyway, enough banging on about me. What did I find? What I found was that while the evidence behind the fat makes you fat story was very, very thin on the ground, there was an alternate story being developed in the UK during the 1950s by a fellow by the name of John Yudkin, head of the London School of Nutrition. And John had noticed something which finally, we get to the graph, is obvious from that graph, which is that there seemed to be a very strong correlation between sugar intake, the white dots there are the English numbers, and the black dots are the American numbers that take on from there. He noticed a very strong correlation between sugar intake and obesity levels. And he said, you know what? Maybe it's sugar. Because he'd been trying for years to make rats in a lab fat by feeding them fat without any success. Try as he might, he could not make any lab animal fat by feeding it fat. But he could very successfully do it by feeding them sugar. And if he got very specific about the sugar he fed them, in particular, he gave them the fructose half of sugar, what we call sucrose, or what we call sugar, is half glucose and half fructose. And he found that if he gave them the fructose half, not only did he make them fat, but he also caused all sorts of metabolic disorders. He wrecked their livers, he wrecked their hearts, he wrecked their insulin resistance. All of these horrible things happened if he fed them pure fructose. Now, that's very interesting for rats, but we're not rats. And there's a lot of differences between our metabolism and rats' metabolisms. But we've got a correlation, which on its own means nothing. I mean, I could have put car sales up there and you probably would have got a similar line. We've got correlation, which is just a signal that maybe this is worth looking at. We've got animal studies, which say, oh, hang on, there might be a mechanism for it. But it doesn't prove anything until you come up with viable, testable explanations at a biochemical level. And it wasn't until the 1990s that we had enough information about how the human body works to come up with those. So I'll give you a brief overview of what we found. But what I found from reading the research is I didn't do any research. I just read some papers. But here's the summary. It appears that fructose, which is an extremely rare substance in our society, extremely rare, well, not now, but prior to about 1820, extremely rare. You'll see there that the line kicks up pretty substantially just before 1850. Prior to that, the only real source of fructose in the average person's diet was from ripe fruit or honey. So ripe fruit, if you happen to have it in season, or honey, if you knew somebody with some bees. And in total, our consumption of fructose was the equivalent of about 1 1/3 teaspoons of sugar a day in total. 1 1/3. That's not much. But to give you some context, a glass of apple juice this big has 9 teaspoons of sugar. Okay, so 1 1/3 total per person per day was our consumption before that line really kicked up in the early 1800s. Now, the average Australian is consuming somewhere around 35 to 40 teaspoons a day. So going from 1-ish to 35-ish in the space of 150 years. Now, the entire several hundred thousand years of our evolution prior to the early 1800s, we'd never had more than 1-ish. So you might expect that we're not particularly well adapted to a substance which is that rare in our environment. Certainly not in the quantities where we've multiplied it by 30. And it turns out that the biochemistry backs up that hypothesis. What happens to fructose is that unlike the glucose half of sugar, for which we have very definite metabolic controls, when we consume glucose, which is either directly or through any carbohydrate, all carbohydrates ultimately end up as glucose. Glucose is our fuel. We are a machine that runs on a fuel of glucose. We have a plan B, which is running on a fuel of fat, but if glucose is available, we'll use it. We have fine-tuned metabolic controls for that, that shut down our appetite as soon as we have enough energy from that glucose. Not reading the labels, not counting the calories, the body is just doing this on autopilot, just like every other animal on the planet. Detects the amount of glucose in our bloodstream, ups the insulin. The insulin is an appetite suppressant, tells us to stop eating in the middle of a meal, if it's working. So if our appetite control is working, when we eat, we are told to stop as soon as we've had enough glucose. This does not happen for fructose, because fructose can't be used for energy by any cell in our body. Unlike glucose, which is used for energy by every cell in our body, fructose can't be used at all by any cell except our liver. And what our liver does with it is immediately convert it to fat. Immediately. Converts it to fat, which it then wraps around the liver in a form of fat called visceral fat. The most dangerous fat that we could possibly have. Not a problem when we're only consuming a teaspoon of the stuff a day. A very big problem when we're consuming 35 teaspoons of it a day. So I looked at that and I thought to myself, well, obviously, all I have to do is stop eating fructose, and two great things will happen. One, I will stop immediately converting half my food to fat, and two, my appetite control will be restored. Because fructose is invisible to the appetite control system. It does not trigger an insulin response, which is why it's the lowest glycemic index food available. It does not trigger an insulin response. Now, so what? Well, insulin shuts down our appetite control. No insulin response, no shutdown. So it messes with our appetite control. It turns out it does something else to our appetite control. There's another hormone that was discovered in the mid-1990s called leptin. Now, leptin is made by every fat cell in our body. It's our long-term fuel gauge. More fat cells, more leptin. It is an appetite suppressant. It actually suppresses appetite for external food and increases the fat burning from internal storage. So it's a beautiful little self-management system. The more fat you have, the more leptin you have, the more you'll be burning your own fat rather than requiring food, so your appetite is suppressed between meals. It turns out that that visceral fat, that fat that accumulates around the liver, affects that leptin signaling. So not only is fructose shutting down our in-meal appetite control, it's shutting down our between-meal appetite control as well. So you might expect, given that a population being fed fructose in any kind of quantity might increase the number of calories they're eating. And so we get back to the observation that more calories in makes you fat. Yeah, that's an observation, but it's about as helpful as saying that alcoholics are alcoholics because they drink alcohol. Yes, you will gain weight if you eat more calories, but the real question is, why are you eating more calories? And fructose provides an answer, which is, it's a metabolic control problem. We are consuming a metabolic disruptor which interferes with our ability to count calories. top line, calorie intake. Prior to there, which is 1970, the left end of this graph, it was pretty much flat. After that, it's increased at about 1% a year. So 1% a year, the number of calories the average person is consuming has increased. Doesn't sound like much. It isn't much. It's a Monte Carlo a day, tops, if you're lucky. It's nothing. It's the cumulative effect, though. The cumulative effect is that over 30 years, you've increased your calorie intake by 30%. Fructose provides that explanation. It doesn't mean that when you consume fructose, you instantaneously disable your appetite control. It means that if you do it every day for your life, you will progressively disable it. It's a cumulative effect. Now, by the way, the other thing I put on that graph, just out of interest, is soft drink consumption. That's the bottom grey line. And the reason I put it there is because 30% of the calories we get from fructose these days come from soft drink. And that's been on a steady climb during the same period. Okay, so that's all very interesting if you're selling, I guess, weight loss products, in that we now have an explanation for it, although everyone ignores them, explanation for it, because they still tell us that what we need to do is stop eating fat and exercise more. But weight is the least of your concerns if you're consuming fructose, the very least of your concerns. Yes, deleting it from your diet will restore your appetite control to full function. Yes, it will mean that you can then spend the rest of your life not worrying about food. You will no longer be obsessed by it. You will no longer crave it. You will no longer have to have morning and afternoon tea. In fact, you will find yourself planning ahead a little bit and thinking, you know what, I've got such a really good functioning appetite control system that if I have afternoon tea, I'm probably not going to have dinner. So which would I prefer more? The afternoon tea or the dinner? You have to do a little bit of forward planning, but a functioning appetite control system is the result of removing the fructose. That means that you automatically lose weight and that the weight stays off. It does not mean you turn into an Adonis, clearly. It means that you hit a weight that your body is prepared to use on autopilot and you stay there. I stayed this weight for 9 years. Sure, I'd like to be thinner, but this is obviously the way my body operates at on autopilot. That suits me too, because I now no longer have to worry about weight, whereas before, if I looked sideways at a packet of Tim Tams, I'd put on a kilo. Now, I'm not even thinking about food, other than when I'm talking to people about it, obviously. But much worse than the weight is the metabolic disorders that fructose causes. Diabetes, type 2 diabetes. These are Australian numbers. We've gone from just about nothing. Oh, you can't see the dates on. This is 1981 here to 2005 at the other end. So that's 20 years worth of data on type 2 diabetes in Australia. Now, people often look at that chart and think I made it up because I made it a nice smooth line. It's not. This is actual data. All I did was download it, put it into a spreadsheet and press graph. So the bottom line, by the way, is type 1 diabetes. It's increasing too, but so insignificant in comparison to type 2 diabetes that it almost doesn't matter. 1.4 million is the current estimate of people affected by type 2 diabetes in Australia. Type 2 diabetes is a direct result of fructose consumption. That fat that wraps around the liver, visceral fat, absolutely without any shadow of a doubt, is associated with the mechanism that leads to insulin resistance and then cascades through to type 2 diabetes. And there are many cascades from type 2 diabetes and insulin resistance, not the least of which are Alzheimer's, which I don't have time to go into in detail here today. But you can't look at that graph and tell me that something unusual isn't going on. That is epidemic scale. 20 years, we've gone from almost nothing to truly frightening amounts, and the graph is going in very, very much the wrong direction. And the only thing that's changed in those 20 years is the amount of fructose we're consuming. The only significant thing from a metabolic perspective. Now, this cascades through to a bunch of other diseases, which I'm not going to talk about today. I normally would, but I'm not going to, because Jamie's asked me to talk about something else today, which is the seed oil problem as well. So I'm going to move swiftly on from sugar and talk about seed oils. So what is a seed oil? A seed oil is a polyunsaturated fat. Polyunsaturated fats are the things that we're encouraged to eat. The Heart Foundation tells us we should be eating it constantly. We should be lining up at the supermarket and filling our trolleys with margarine and throwing all butter away. Margarine is made from polyunsaturated fats. The polyunsaturated fats used in margarine are what I would call a seed oil, which is shorthand for oils extracted from seeds by mechanical means. They did not exist in human history prior to about there, which is 1909. This graph, by the way, goes 1909 to 2005. Prior to that, fat in the human diet consisted of animal fat, with occasional access, depending on where you lived, to what I would call tropical fruit oils, like olive oil, coconut oil, palm oil, and avocado oil. So prior to that, the only sources of polyunsaturated fat in the diet were fish, which is a small amount of omega-3, and the tropical fruit oils in equatorial regions. After the 1900s, when the Americans discovered how you could extract really valuable oil from seeds that were otherwise being thrown in the bin, cotton seeds largely, and then ultimately soybeans, it steadily got used more and more and more until when we get to the other end of that graph, almost 100% of dietary fat being delivered to the US and Australian population is based on seed oils. So there's almost no animal fat in our diet. So when the Heart Foundation admonishes you to stay away from those evil animal fats, you'd find that almost impossible to do. You find it almost impossible to eat the animal fats because they just don't exist in our dietary system. That is a massive change in the space of 100 years. Even worse is when you start to notice other correlations. So this correlation is with melanoma. The grey line at the bottom is incidence of melanoma in the United States. So these are US polyunsaturated fats figures and US melanoma figures. The reason I've chosen melanoma as an example of cancer is simply because it's the one we have the earliest records for. It's the most easily diagnosed cancer. So we've got good records going back to 1935. Now, they'll tell you that melanoma is caused by sunshine, but I find it very, very difficult to believe that a child in 2000 is exposed to, what, 40, 50 times as much sunshine as a child in 1935? That's just plain out unreasonable. But that logic seems to have escaped anyone telling us about what causes melanoma. Once again, it's a correlation. It proves nothing. But it should alert us to something, which is that it's a pretty strong correlation, very strong correlation, even to the point where the little bumps are almost in line. They're just 30 years apart. Doctors have noticed this. In particular, a fellow by the name of Bruce Mackey in Sydney in the early 1970s noticed this and started looking for the amount of polyunsaturated fat in the fat cells of his patients versus the incidence of melanoma in his patients. And he found the same correlation. And all that's missing now is an explanation. And there are good biochemical explanations for why a polyunsaturated fat, in particular the omega-6 oil, which dominates oils from seeds, would be a causative agent for cancers and not just melanoma. Probably don't have time to go into it in a great deal of detail, but I do want to point out a few things about polyunsaturated fat. The Heart Foundation will tell you that what you need to do to avoid having a heart attack or anything else really is stay away from places like McDonald's and eat lots of margarine. But there's no functional difference between what McDonald's are cooking their chips in and what's being sold to you as margarine. They're both seed oils, both high in polyunsaturated fats. And I just did this little exercise for the fun of it. A little hard to see from the bottom here, but what this is a small, medium, and large fries. The blue one is the current levels of polyunsaturated fat, from, and these are McDonald's. And the red ones are what they were prior to 2004. So, in 2004, McDonald's was persuaded by the Heart Foundation to change its then cooking oil, which was largely tallow or beef fat, for canola oil. And they took their polyunsaturated fat content from, in a small fries, about half a gram to about four, and a large fries up over almost 7 grams. Now, given that, I would suggest that for the average adult in Australia today, 6 grams is the maximum, absolute maximum per day you should be consuming of this stuff. That's going to put most of us a long way in trouble. Now, I caused a bit of a stir recently on my Facebook page by posting this graph, but I just wanted to put it up here for your benefit as well. The reason I caused a stir was because I didn't put the two red lines in there before I posted it. And people got all worried about bacon. And you should worry about bacon, because in Australia, bacon is largely lot-fed, and which means that most of the fat, the polyunsaturated fat in it, is very high in omega-6 oils. If it's an organic bacon, it'll be in a different position on that graph. But still, it's worth noticing where the meats rank in terms of polyunsaturated fat content. It's also worth noticing that these are all 100 grams. This is only 20 grams, and so is the butter. 20 grams is the amount you would spread on a couple of pieces of toast. So you eat a margarine, your polyunsaturated fat is going off the scale. Butter, barely noticeable. And this one, I really don't have time to talk about this in detail, but I will just mention it. Humans are not adapted to large quantities of polyunsaturated fat, to the point where humans, unlike cows, accumulate any polyunsaturated fats they can find, particularly mothers, in their subcutaneous fat stores. The reason they do it is because it's such a rare fat in our natural environment that we are designed to store as much of it as we can get a hold of. Why? Because it's really handy stuff for building babies. When you're making a baby, building a brain, building a nervous system and an immune system, you need good supplies of omega-3 and omega-6 polyunsaturated fats. Unfortunately, we have no upper limit on storage. So when you feed a mother corn oil, which is at percentages which are similar to the current dietary load of polyunsaturated fat, when you feed a mother corn oil, her breast milk will contain that much polyunsaturated fat. Oh, okay. So I know I'm really pushing it with time here, but this is an important one, so I just want to...
We'll come back on.
Okay. So this is human breast milk when a mother is fed corn oil. Polyunsaturated fat, very, very high, up at about 1.4 grams per 100 mils. This is human breast milk for Bedouin peoples. Human breast milk on a mother who's being fed lard, not meaning that that's the only thing she's eating, just that's where the fat is in her diet. This is for a Lebanese mother, and these are formulas. So that's Caricare Goat, Caricare Infant, S26 Newborn, Bellamy's Organic Infant, Heinz Nurture. Now, the Australian standard up there is based on research which I regard as not complete. I think the minimum's probably a good line. The maximum, I'm not so sure about. The interesting thing here, if you want to take anything away from this, is the difference between just what the mother is eating. So this is just what the mother is eating affects it massively. Lard, seed oil. That means that the child is consuming a much higher percentage of their diet from polyunsaturated fat if the mother is consuming seed oils. And in Australian society today, the mother has no choice but to be consuming seed oils. You have to go out of your way not to be consuming them. Now, I've really pushed it with the timing, so I'll just leave it there. And I'll be back this afternoon for the panel session to answer any questions.
Thank you, David. If you do nothing else, go back and read the book or go buy the book.